Unity, because he never sent me anything until you showed up, says Peeta. I haven't thought much about this. How it must have looked from Peeta's perspective when I appeared in the arena, having received burn medicine and bread, when he, who was at death's door, had gotten nothing. Like Haymitch was keeping me alive at his expense.
Look, boy, Haymitch begins.
Don't bother, Haymitch. I know you had to choose one of us, and I'd have wanted it to be her. But this is something different. People are dead out there. More will follow unless we are very good.
We all know I'm better than Katniss in front of the cameras.
No one needs to coach me on what to say, but I have to know what I'm walking into, says Peeta.
From now on, you'll be fully informed, Haymitch promises.
I better be, says Peeta. He doesn't even bother to look at me before he leaves.
The dust he disrupted billows up and looks for new places to land. My hair, my eyes, my shiny gold pin. Did you choose me, Haymitch? I ask.
Yeah,
he says. Why? You like him better, I say.
That's true. But remember, until they change the rules, I could only hope to get one of you out of there alive, he says. I thought since he was determined to protect you, well, between the three of us, we might be able to bring you home.
Oh, is all I can think to say.
You'll see. The choices you'll have to make, if we survive this, says Haymitch. You'll learn.
Well, I've learned one thing today. This place is not a larger version of District 12. Our fence is unguarded and rarely charged. Our peacekeepers are unwelcome but less brutal. Our hardships evoke more fatigue than fury. Here in 11, they suffer more acutely and feel more desperation. President Snow is right. A spark could be enough to set them ablaze. Everything is happening too fast for me to process it. The warning, the shootings, the recognition that I may have set something of great consequence in motion. The whole thing is so improbable. And it would be one thing if I had planned to stir things up, but given the circumstances, how on earth did I cause so much trouble?
Come on, we've got a dinner to attend, says Haymitch.
I stand in the shower as long as they let me, before I have to come out to be readied. The prep team seems oblivious to the events of the day. They're all excited about the dinner. In the districts, they're important enough to attend, whereas back in the capital, they almost never score invitations to prestigious parties. While they try to predict what dishes will be served, I keep seeing the old man's head being blown off. I don't even pay attention to what anyone is doing to me until I'm about to leave and I see myself in the mirror. A pale pink strapless dress brushes my shoes. My hair is pinned back from my face and falling down my back in a shower of ringlets. Cinna comes up behind me and arranges a shimmering silver wrap around my shoulders. He catches my eye in the mirror.
Like it?
It's beautiful, as always, I say.
Let's see how it looks with a smile, he says gently.
It's his reminder that in a minute there will be cameras again. I manage to raise the corners of my lips.
There we go.
When we all assemble to go down to the dinner, I can see Effie is out of sorts. Surely Haymitch hasn't told her about what happened in the square. I wouldn't be surprised if Cinna and Portia know, but there seems to be an unspoken agreement to leave Effie out of the bad news loop. It doesn't take long to hear about the problem, though. Effie runs through the evening schedule, then tosses it aside.
And then, thank goodness, we can all get on that train and get out of here, she says.
Is something wrong, Effie? Asks Cinna.
I don't like the way we've been treated. being stuffed into trucks and barred from the platform. And then, but an hour ago, I decided to look around the Justice Building. I'm something of an expert in architectural design, you know, she says.
Oh, yes, I've heard that, says Portia before the pause gets too long.
So I was just having a peek around because district ruins are going to be all the rage this year, when two peacemakers showed up and ordered me back to our quarters. One of them actually poked me with her gun, says Effie.
I can't help thinking this is the direct result of Haymitch, Peter, and me disappearing earlier in the day. It's a little reassuring, actually, to think that Haymitch might have been right, that no one would have been monitoring the dusty dome where we talked. Although, I bet they are now. Effie looks so distressed that I spontaneously give her a hug.
That's awful, Effie. Maybe we shouldn't go to the dinner at all, at least until they've apologized.
I know she'll never agree to this, but she brightens considerably at the suggestion, at the validation of her complaint.
No, I'll manage. It's part of my job to weather the ups and downs. And we can't let you two miss your dinner, she says. But thank you for the offer, Katniss.
Effie arranges us in formation for our entrance. First the prep teams, then her, the stylists, Haymitch. Peter and I, of course, bring up the rear. Somewhere below, musicians begin to play. As the first wave of our little procession begins down the steps, Peter and I join hands. Haymitch says I was wrong to yell at you. You were only operating under his instructions, says Peter. And it isn't as if I haven't kept things from you in the past. I remember the shock of hearing Peter confess his love for me in front of all of Panem. Haymitch had known about that and not told me. I think I broke a few things myself after that interview.
Just an urn, he says.
And your hands. There's no point to it any more, though, is there? Not being straight with each other, I say.
No point, says Peter.
We stand at the top of the stairs, giving Haymitch a 15-step lead as Effie directed.
Was that really the only time you kissed Gale?
I'm so startled, I answer, yes. With all that has happened today, has that question actually been preying on him?
That's 15. Let's do it, he says.
A light hits us, and I put on the most dazzling smile I can. We descend the steps and are sucked into what becomes an indistinguishable round of dinners, ceremonies, and train rides. Each day it's the same. Wake up, get dressed, ride through cheering crowds, listen to a speech in our honor, give a thank you speech in return, but only the one the Capitol gave us. Never any personal additions now. Sometimes a brief tour, a glimpse of the sea in one district, towering forests in another, ugly factories, fields of wheat, stinking refineries. Dress in evening clothes, attend dinner, train. During ceremonies we are solemn and respectful, but always linked together by our hands, our arms. At dinners, we are borderline delirious in our love for each other. We kiss, we dance, we get caught trying to sneak away to be alone. On the train, we are quietly miserable as we try to assess what effect we might be having. Even without our personal speeches to trigger dissent, needless to say, the ones we gave in District 11 were edited out before the event was broadcast. You can feel something in the air. The rolling boil of a pot about to run over. Not everywhere. Some crowds have the weary cattle feel that I know District 12 usually projects at the victors' ceremonies. But in others, particularly 8, 4, and 3, there is a genuine elation in the faces of the people at the sight of us, and under the elation, fury. When they chant my name, it is more of a cry for vengeance than a cheer. When the peacekeepers move in to quiet an unruly crowd, it presses back instead of retreating. And I know that there's nothing I could ever do to change this. No show of love, however believable, will turn this tide. If my holding out those berries was an act of temporary insanity, then these people will embrace insanity too. Cinna begins to take in my clothes around the waist. The prep team frets over the circles under my eyes. Effie starts giving me pills to sleep, but they don't work. Not well enough. I drift off only to be roused by nightmares that have increased in number and intensity. Peter, who spends much of the night roaming the train, hears me screaming as I struggle to break out of the haze of drugs that merely prolong the horrible dreams. He manages to wake me and calm me down. Then he climbs into bed to hold me until I fall back to sleep. After that, I refuse the pills, but every night I let him into my bed. We manage the darkness as we did in the arena, wrapped in each other's arms, guarding against dangers that can descend at any moment. Nothing else happens, but our arrangement quickly becomes a subject of gossip on the train. When Effie brings it up to me, I think, good, maybe it will get back to President Snow. I tell her we'll make an effort to be more discreet, but we don't. The back-to-back appearances in 2 and 1 are their own special kind of awful. Cato and Clove, the tributes from District 2, might have both made it home if Peter and I hadn't. I personally killed the girl, Glimmer, and the boy from District 1. As I tried to avoid looking at his family, I learned that his name was Marvel. How did I never know that? I suppose that before the games I didn't pay attention, and afterward I didn't want to know. By the time we reach the capital, we are desperate. We make endless appearances to adoring crowds. There is no danger of an uprising here among the privileged, among those whose names are never placed in the reaping balls, whose children never die for the supposed crimes committed generations ago. We don't need to convince anybody in the capital of our love, but hold to the slim hope that we can still reach some of those we failed to convince in the districts. Whatever we do seems too little, too late. Back in our old quarters in the training center, I'm the one who suggests the public marriage proposal. Peter agrees to do it, but then disappears to his room for a long time. Hamish tells me to leave him alone. I thought he wanted it anyway, I say. Not like this, Hamish says. He wanted it to be real. I go back to my room and lie under the covers, trying not to think of Gale, and thinking of nothing else. That night, on the stage before the training center, we bubble our way through a list of questions. Caesar Flickerman, in his twinkling midnight blue suit, his hair, eyelids, and lips still dyed powder blue, flawlessly guides us through the interview. When he asks us about the future, Peter gets down on one knee, pours out his heart, and begs me to marry him. I, of course, accept. Caesar is beside himself. The capital audience is hysterical. Shots of crowds around Panem show a country besotted with happiness. President Snow himself makes a surprise visit to congratulate us. He clasps Peter's hand and gives him an approving slap on the shoulder. He embraces me, enfolding me in the smell of blood and roses, and plants a puffy kiss on my cheek. When he pulls back, his fingers digging into my arms, his face smiling into mine, I dare to raise my eyebrows. They ask what my lips can't. Did I do it? Was it enough? Was giving everything over to you, keeping up the game, promising to marry Peter, enough? In answer, he gives an almost imperceptible shake of his head.
Chapter 6.
In that one slight motion, I see the end of hope, the beginning of the destruction of everything I hold dear in the world. I can't guess what form my punishment will take, how wide the net will be cast, but when it is finished, there will most likely be nothing left. So you would think that at this moment I would be in utter despair. Here's what's strange. The main thing I feel is a sense of relief, that I can give up this game, that the question of whether I can succeed in this venture has been answered, even if that answer is a resounding no, that if desperate times call for desperate measures, then I am free to act as desperately as I wish. Only not here. Not quite yet. It's essential to get back to District 12, because the main part of any plan will include my mother and sister, Gale and his family, and Peter, if I can get him to come with us. I add Haymitch to the list. These are the people I must take with me when I escape into the wild. How I will convince them where we will go in the dead of winter, what it will take to evade capture, are unanswered questions. But at least now I know what I must do. So instead of crumpling to the ground and weeping, I find myself standing up straighter and with more confidence than I have in weeks. My smile, while somewhat insane, is not forced. And when President Snow silences the audience and says, "What do you think about us throwing them a wedding right here in the Capitol?" I pull off girl almost catatonic with joy without a hitch. Caesar Flickerman asks if the president has a date in mind.
"Oh, before we set a date, we better clear it with Katniss's mother," says the president.
The audience gives a big laugh, and the president puts his arm around me.
"Maybe if the whole country puts its mind to it, we can get you married before you're 30.
"You'll probably have to pass a new law," I say with a giggle.
"If that's what it takes," says the president with conspiratorial good humor.
Oh, the fun we two have together. The party, held in the banquet room of President Snow's mansion, has no equal. The 40-foot ceiling has been transformed into the night sky, and the stars look exactly as they do at home. I suppose they look the same from the Capitol, but who would know? There's always too much light from the city to see the stars here. About halfway between the floor and the ceiling, musicians float on what look like fluffy white clouds, but I can't see what holds them aloft. Traditional dining tables have been replaced by innumerable stuffed sofas and chairs, some surrounding fireplaces, others beside fragrant flower gardens or ponds filled with exotic fish, so that people can eat and drink and do whatever they please in the utmost comfort. There's a large tiled area in the center of the room that serves as everything from a dance floor to a stage for the performers who come and go, to another spot to mingle with the flamboyantly dressed guests. But the real star of the evening is the food. Tables laden with delicacies line the walls. Everything you can think of and things you have never dreamed of lie in wait. Whole roasted cows and pigs and goats still turning on spits. Huge platters of fowl stuffed with savory fruits and nuts. Ocean creatures drizzled in sauces or begging to be dipped in spicy concoctions. Countless cheeses, breads, vegetables, sweets, waterfalls of wine, and streams of spirits that flicker with flames. My appetite has returned with my desire to fight back. After weeks of feeling too worried to eat, I'm famished. "I want to taste everything in the room," I tell Peter. I can see him trying to read my expression, to figure out my transformation.
Since he doesn't know that President Snow thinks I have failed, he can only assume that I think we have succeeded. Perhaps even that I have some genuine happiness at our engagement. His eyes reflect his puzzlement, but only briefly, because we're on camera.
"Then you'd better pace yourself," he says.
"Okay, no more than one bite of each dish," I say. My resolve is almost immediately broken at the first table, which has 20 or so soups, when I encounter a creamy pumpkin brew sprinkled with slivered nuts and tiny black seeds. "I could just eat this all night," I exclaim. But I don't. I weaken again at a clear green broth that I can only describe as tasting like springtime, and again when I try a frothy pink soup dotted with raspberries. Faces appear, names are exchanged, pictures taken, kisses brushed on cheeks. Apparently my Mockingjay pin has spawned a new fashion sensation, because several people come up to show me their accessories. My bird has been replicated on belt buckles, embroidered into silk lapels, even tattooed in intimate places. Everyone wants to wear the winner's token. I can only imagine how nuts that makes President Snow. But what can he do? The games were such a hit here, where the berries were only a symbol of a desperate girl trying to save her lover. Peter and I make no effort to find company, but are constantly sought out. We are what no one wants to miss at the party. I act delighted, but I have zero interest in these capital people. They are only distractions from the food. Every table presents new temptations, and even on my restricted one-taste-per-dish regimen, I begin filling up quickly. I pick up a small roasted bird and bite into it, and my tongue floods with orange sauce. Delicious. But I make Peter eat the remainder because I want to keep tasting things and the idea of throwing away food, as I see so many people doing so casually, is abhorrent to me. After about 10 tables, I'm stuffed, and we've only sampled a small number of the dishes available. Just then, my prep team descends on us. They're nearly incoherent between the alcohol they've consumed and their ecstasy at being at such a grand affair.
"Why aren't you eating?"
asks Octavia. "I have been, but I can't hold another bite," I say. They all laugh as if that's the silliest thing they've ever heard.
"No one lets that stop them," says Flavius.
They lead us over to a table that holds tiny-stemmed wine glasses filled with clear liquid.
"Drink this."
Peter picks one up to take a sip, and they lose it.
"Not here," shrieks Octavia.
"You have to do it in there,"
says Venia, pointing to a door that leads to the toilets.
"Or you'll get it all over the floor."
Peter looks at the glass again and puts it together.
"You mean this will make me puke?"
My prep team laughs hysterically.
"Of course, so you can keep eating," says Octavia. "I've been in there twice already. Everyone does it, or else how would you have any fun at a feast?"
I'm speechless, staring at the pretty little glasses and all they imply. Peter sets his back on the table with such precision you'd think it might detonate. "Come on, Katniss, let's dance." Music filters down from the clouds as he leads me away from the team, the table, and out onto the floor. We know only a few dances at home, the kind that go with fiddle and flute music and require a good deal of space. But Effie has shown us some that are popular in the capital. The music's slow and dreamlike, so Peter pulls me into his arms and we move in a circle with practically no steps at all. You could do this dance on a pie plate. We're quiet for a while. Then Peter speaks in a strained voice.
You go along, thinking you can deal with it, thinking maybe they're not so bad, and then you...
He cuts himself off. All I can think of is the emaciated bodies of the children on our kitchen table as my mother prescribes what the parents can't give. More food. Now that we're rich, she'll send some home with them. But often in the old days, there was nothing to give, and the child was past saving anyway. And here in the capital, they're vomiting for the pleasure of filling their bellies again and again. Not from some illness of body or mind. Not from spoiled food. It's what everyone does at a party. Expected, part of the fun. One day when I dropped by to give Hazel the game, Vic was homesick with a bad cough. Being part of Gail's family, the kid has to eat better than 90% of the rest of District 12. But he still spent about 15 minutes talking about how they'd open a can of corn syrup from parcel day, and each had a spoonful on bread, and were going to maybe have more later in the week. How Hazel had said he could have a bit in a cup of tea to soothe his cough, but he wouldn't feel right unless the others had some too. If it's like that at Gale's, what's it like in the other houses? Peter, they bring us here to fight to the death for their entertainment, I say. Really, this is nothing by comparison.
I know that. It's just sometimes I can't stand it anymore. To the point where... I'm not sure what I'll do.
He pauses, then whispers.
Maybe we were wrong, Katniss.
About what? I ask.
About trying to subdue things in the districts, he says.
My head turns swiftly from side to side, but no one seems to have heard. The camera crew got sidetracked at a table of shellfish, and the couples dancing around us are either too drunk or too self-involved to notice.
Sorry,
he says. He should be. This is no place to be voicing such thoughts.
Save it for home, I tell him.
Just then, Portia appears with a large man who looks vaguely familiar. She introduces him as Plutarch Heavensby, the new head game maker. Plutarch asks Peeta if he can steal me for a dance. Peeta's recovered his camera face and good-naturedly passes me over, warning the man not to get too attached. I don't want to dance with Plutarch Heavensby. I don't want to feel his hands, one resting against mine, one on my hip. I'm not used to being touched, except by Peeta or my family, and I rank game makers somewhere below maggots in terms of creatures I want in contact with my skin. But he seems to sense this and holds me almost at arm's length as we turn on the floor. We chit-chat about the party, about the entertainment, about the food, and then he makes a joke about avoiding punch since training. I don't get it, and then I realize he's the man who tripped backward into the punch bowl when I shot an arrow at the game makers during the training session. Well, not really. I was shooting an apple out of their roast pig's mouth. But I made them jump.
Oh, you're the one who...
I laugh, remembering him splashing back into the punch bowl.
Yes. And you'll be pleased to know I've never recovered, says Plutarch.
I want to point out that 22 dead tributes will never recover from the games he helped create, either. But I only say, good, so you're the head game maker this year. That must be a big honor.
Between you and me, there weren't many takers for the job, he says. So much responsibility as to how the games turn out.
Yeah, the last guy's dead, I think. He must know about Seneca Crane, but he doesn't look the least bit concerned. Are you planning the Quarter Quell games already? I say.
Oh, yes. Well, they've been in the works for years, of course. Arenas aren't built in a day. But the, shall we say, flavor of the games is being determined now. Believe it or not, I've got a strategy meeting tonight, he says.
Plutarch steps back and pulls out a gold watch on a chain from a vest pocket. He flips open the lid, sees the time, and frowns.
I'll have to be going soon.
He turns the watch so I can see the face.
It starts at midnight.
That seems late for, I say, but then something distracts me. Plutarch has run his thumb across the crystal face of the watch, and for just a moment an image appears, glowing as if lit by candlelight. It's another mockingjay, exactly like the pin on my dress. Only this one disappears. He snaps the watch closed. That's very pretty, I say.
Oh, it's more than pretty. It's one of a kind, he says.
If anyone asks about me, say I've gone home to bed. The meetings are supposed to be kept secret,
but I thought it'd be safe to tell you.
Yes, your secret's safe with me, I say. As we shake hands, he gives a small bow, a common gesture here in the capital.
Well, I'll see you next summer at the games, Katniss.
Best wishes on your engagement and good luck with your mother. I'll need it, I say. Plutarch disappears, and I wander through the crowd looking for Peter. As strangers congratulate me on my engagement, on my victory at the games, on my choice of lipstick. I respond, but really I'm thinking about Plutarch showing off his pretty one-of-a-kind watch to me. There was something strange about it, almost clandestine. But why? Maybe he thinks someone else will steal his idea of putting a disappearing mockingjay on a watch face. Yes, he probably paid a fortune for it, and now he can't show it to anyone because he's afraid someone will make a cheap knockoff version. Only in the capital. I find Peter admiring a table of elaborately decorated cakes. Bakers have come in from the kitchen especially to talk frosting with him, and you can see them tripping over one another to answer his questions. At his request, they assemble an assortment of little cakes for him to take back to District 12, where he can examine their work in quiet. Effie said we have to be on the train at 1. I wonder what time it is, he says, glancing around. Almost midnight, I reply. I pluck a chocolate flower from a cake with my fingers and nibble on it, so beyond worrying about manners.
Time to say thank you and farewell, trills Effie at my elbow.
It's one of those moments when I just love her compulsive punctuality. We collect Cinna and Portia, and she escorts us around to say goodbye to important people, then herds us to the door.
Shouldn't we thank President Snow? Asks Peter. It's his house.
Oh, he's not a big one for parties. Too busy, says Effie. I've already arranged for the necessary notes and gifts to be sent to him tomorrow. There you are!
Effie gives a little wave to two capital attendants, who have an inebriated Haymitch propped up between them. We travel through the streets of the capital in a car with darkened windows. Behind us, another car brings the prep teams. The throngs of people celebrating are so thick, it's slow going. But Effie has this all down to a science, and at exactly 1 o'clock we are back on the train, and it's pulling out of the station. Haymitch is deposited in his room. Cinna orders tea, and we all take seats around the table while Effie rattles her schedule papers and reminds us we're still on tour.
There's the Harvest Festival in District 12 to think about, so I suggest we drink our tea and head straight to bed.
No one argues. When I open my eyes, it's early afternoon. My head rests on Peter's arm. I don't remember him coming in last night. I turn, being careful not to disturb him, but he's already awake.
No nightmares, he says.
What? I ask.
You didn't have any nightmares last night, he says.
He's right. For the first time in ages, I've slept through the night.
I had a dream, though, I say, thinking back. I was following a mockingjay through the woods for a long time. It was Rue, really. I mean, when it sang, it had her voice.
Where did she take you? He says, brushing my hair off my forehead.
I don't know. We never arrived, I say, but I felt happy.
Well, you slept like you were happy, he says.
Peter, how come I never know when you're having a nightmare? I say.
I don't know. I don't think I cry out or thrash around or anything. I just come to paralyzed with terror, he says.
You should wake me, I say, thinking about how I can interrupt his sleep 2 or 3 times on a bad night, about how long it can take to calm me down.
It's not necessary. My nightmares are usually about losing you, he says. I'm okay, once I realize you're here.
Ugh. Peter makes comments like this in such an offhand way, and it's like being hit in the gut. He's only answering my question honestly. He's not pressing me to reply in kind, to make any declaration of love, but I still feel awful, as if I've been using him in some terrible way. Have I? I don't know. I only know that for the first time, I feel immoral about him being here in my bed, which is ironic, since we're officially engaged now.
Be worse when we're home and I'm sleeping alone again, he says.
That's right. We're almost home.
The agenda for District 12 includes a dinner at Mayor Undersea's house tonight and a victory rally in the square during the Harvest Festival tomorrow. We always celebrate the Harvest Festival on the final day of the victory tour, but usually it means a meal at home or with a few friends if you can afford it. This year it will be a public affair, and since the capital will be throwing it, everyone in the whole district will have full bellies. Most of our prepping will take place at the mayor's house, since we're back to being covered in furs for outdoor appearances. We're only at the train station briefly, to smile and wave as we pile into our car. We don't even get to see our families until the dinner tonight. I'm glad it will be at the mayor's house instead of at the Justice Building, where the memorial for my father was held, where they took me after the reaping for those wrenching goodbyes to my family. The Justice Building is too full of sadness. But I like Mayor Undersea's house, especially now that his daughter Madge and I are friends. We always were, in a way. It became official when she came to say goodbye to me before I left for the games, when she gave me the Mockingjay pin for luck. After I got home, we started spending time together. It turns out Madge has plenty of empty hours to fill, too. It was a little awkward at first because we didn't know what to do. Other girls our age, I've heard them talking about boys or other girls or clothes. Madge and I aren't gossipy, and clothes bore me to tears. But after a few false starts, I realized she was dying to go into the woods, so I've taken her a couple of times and showed her how to shoot. She's trying to teach me the piano, but mostly I like to listen to her play. Sometimes we eat at each other's houses. Madge likes mine better. Her parents seem nice, but I don't think she sees a whole lot of them. Her father has District 12 to run, and her mother gets fierce headaches that force her to stay in bed for days. Maybe you should take her to the Capitol, I said during one of them. We weren't playing the piano that day, because even 2 floors away the sound caused her mother pain. They can fix her up, I bet.
Yes, but you don't go to the Capitol unless they invite you, said Madge unhappily.
Even the mayor's privileges are limited.
When we reach the mayor's house, I only have time to give Madge a quick hug before Effie hustles me off to the 3rd floor to get ready. After I'm prepped and dressed in a full-length silver gown, I've still got an hour to kill before the dinner, so I slip off to find her. Madge's bedroom is on the second floor, along with several guest rooms and her father's study. I stick my head in the study to say hello to the mayor, but it's empty. The television's droning on, and I stop to watch shots of Peter and me at the Capitol party last night, dancing, eating, kissing. This will be playing in every household in Panem right now. The audience must be sick to death of the star-crossed lovers from District 12. I know I am. I'm leaving the room when a beeping noise catches my attention. I turn back to see the screen of the television go black. Then the words, "Update on District 8," start flashing. Instinctively, I know this is not for my eyes, but something intended only for the mayor. I should go, quickly. Instead, I find myself stepping closer to the television. An announcer I've never seen before appears. It's a woman with graying hair and a hoarse, authoritative voice. She warns that conditions are worsening and a level 3 alert has been called. Additional forces are being sent into District 8 and all textile production has ceased. They cut away from the woman to the main square in District 8. I recognize it because I was there only last week. There are still banners with my face waving from the rooftops. Below them, there's a mob scene. The square's packed with screaming people, their faces hidden with rags and homemade masks, throwing bricks. Buildings burn. Peacekeepers shoot into the crowd, killing at random. I've never seen anything like it, but I can only be witnessing one thing. This is what President Snow calls an uprising.
Chapter 7.
A leather bag filled with food and a flask of hot tea. A pair of fur-lined gloves that Cinna left behind. 3 twigs, broken from the naked trees, lying in the snow, pointing in the direction I will travel. This is what I leave for Gale at our usual meeting place on the first Sunday after the Harvest Festival. I have continued on through the cold, misty woods, breaking a path that will be unfamiliar to Gale, but is simple for my feet to find. It leads to the lake. I no longer trust that our regular rendezvous spot offers privacy, and I'll need that and more to spill my guts to Gale today. But will he even come? If he doesn't, I'll have no choice but to risk going to his house in the dead of night. There are things he has to know, things I need him to help me figure out. Once the implications of what I was seeing on Mayor Undersea's television hit me, I made for the door and started down the hall. Just in time, too, because the mayor came up the steps moments later. I gave him a wave.
"Looking for Madge?" he said in a friendly tone.
"Yes, I want to show her my dress," I said.
"Well, you know where to find her."
Just then, another round of beeping came from his study. His face turned grave.
"Excuse me," he said.
He went into his study and closed the door tightly. I waited in the hall until I had composed myself, reminded myself I must act naturally. Then I found Madge in her room, sitting at her dressing table, brushing out her wavy blonde hair before a mirror. She was in the same pretty white dress she'd worn on reaping day. She saw my reflection behind her and smiled.
"Look at you! Like you came right off the streets of the Capitol."
I stepped in closer. My fingers touched the mockingjay. "Even my pin now. Mockingjays are all the rage in the Capitol, thanks to you."
"Are you sure you don't want it back?" I asked. "Don't be silly. It was a gift," said Madge.
She tied back her hair in a festive gold ribbon.
"Where did you get it anyway?" I asked. "It was my aunt's," she said. "But I think it's been in the family a long time."
"It's a funny choice, a mockingjay," I said. "I mean, because of what happened in the rebellion."
with the Jabberjays backfiring on the Capitol and all. The Jabberjays were mutations, genetically enhanced male birds created by the Capitol as weapons to spy on rebels in the districts. They could remember and repeat long passages of human speech, so they were sent into rebel areas to capture our words and return them to the Capitol. The rebels caught on and turned them against the Capitol by sending them home loaded with lies. When this was discovered, the Jabberjays were left to die. In a few years, they became extinct in the wild, but not before they had mated with female mockingbirds, creating an entirely new species.
But mockingjays were never a weapon, said Madge. They're just songbirds, right?
Yeah, I guess so, I said. But it's not true. A mockingbird is just a songbird. A mockingjay is a creature the Capitol never intended to exist. They hadn't counted on the highly controlled Jabberjay having the brains to adapt to the wild, to pass on its genetic code, to thrive in a new form. They hadn't anticipated its will to live. Now, as I trudge through the snow, I see the mockingjays hopping about on branches as they pick up on other birds' melodies, replicate them, and then transform them into something new. As always, they remind me of Rue. I think of the dream I had the last night on the train, where I followed her in mockingjay form. I wish I could have stayed asleep just a bit longer and found out where she was trying to take me. It's a hike to the lake, no question. If he decides to follow me at all, Gale's going to be put out by this excessive use of energy that could be better spent in hunting. He was conspicuously absent from the dinner at the mayor's house, although the rest of his family came. Hazel said he was homesick, which was an obvious lie. I couldn't find him at the harvest festival either. Vic told me he was out hunting. That was probably true. After a couple of hours, I reach an old house near the edge of the lake. Maybe house is too big a word for it. It's only one room, about 12 feet square. My father thought that a long time ago there were a lot of buildings. You can still see some of the foundations, and people came to them to play and fish in the lake. This house outlasted the others because it's made of concrete. Floor, roof, ceiling. Only one of 4 glass windows remains, wavy and yellowed by time. There's no plumbing and no electricity, but the fireplace still works, and there's a wood pile in the corner that my father and I collected years ago. I start a small fire, counting on the mist to obscure any telltale smoke. While the fire catches, I sweep out the snow that has accumulated under the empty windows, using a twig broom my father made me when I was about 8, and I played house here. Then I sit on the tiny concrete hearth, thawing out by the fire and waiting for Gale. It's a surprisingly short time before he appears. A bow slung over his shoulder, a dead wild turkey he must have encountered along the way hanging from his belt. He stands in the doorway as if considering whether or not to enter. He holds the unopened leather bag of food, the flask, Cinna's gloves, gifts he will not accept because of his anger at me. I know exactly how he feels. Didn't I do the same thing to my mother? I look in his eyes. His temper can't quite mask the hurt, the sense of betrayal he feels at my engagement to Peter. This will be my last chance, this meeting today, to not lose Gale forever. I could take hours trying to explain, and even then have him refuse me. Instead, I go straight to the heart of my defense. President Snow personally threatened to have you killed, I say. Gale raises his eyebrows slightly, but there's no real show of fear or astonishment.
Anyone else?
Well, he didn't actually give me a copy of the list, but it's a good guess it includes both our families, I say. It's enough to bring him to the fire. He crouches before the hearth and warms himself.
Unless what?
Unless nothing now, I say. Obviously, this requires more of an explanation, but I have no idea where to start, so I just sit there staring gloomily into the fire. After about a minute of this, Gale breaks the silence.
Well, thanks for the heads up.
I turn to him, ready to snap, but I catch the glint in his eye. I hate myself for smiling. This is not a funny moment, but I guess it's a lot to drop on someone.
We're all going to be obliterated no matter what.
I do have a plan, you know.
Yeah, I bet it's a stunner, he says.
He tosses the gloves on my lap.
Here, I don't want your fiancé's old gloves.
He's not my fiancé. That's just part of the act. And these aren't his gloves. They were Cinna's, I say.
Give them back then, he says.
He pulls on the gloves, flexes his fingers, and nods in approval.
At least I'll die in comfort.
That's optimistic. Of course, you don't know what's happened, I say.
Let's have it,
he says. I decide to begin with the night Peeta and I were crowned victors at the Hunger Games, and Haymitch warned me of the capital's fury. I tell him about the uneasiness that dogged me even once I was back home, President Snow's visit to my house, the murders in District 11, the tension in the crowds, the last-ditch effort of the engagement, the president's indication that it hadn't been enough, my certainty that I'll have to pay. Gale never interrupts. While I talk, he tucks the gloves in his pocket and occupies himself with turning the food in the leather bag into a meal for us. Toasting bread and cheese, coring apples, placing chestnuts in the fire to roast. I watch his hands, his beautiful, capable fingers. Scarred, as mine were before the capital erased all marks from my skin, but strong and deft. Hands that have the power to mine coal, but the precision to set a delicate snare. Hands I trust. I pause to take a drink of tea from the flask before I tell him about my homecoming.
Well, you really made a mess of things, he says.
I'm not even done, I tell him.
I've heard enough for the moment. Let's skip ahead to this plan of yours, he says.
I take a deep breath. We run away.
What?
He asks. This has actually caught him off guard. We take to the woods and make a run for it, I say. His face is almost impossible to read. Will he laugh at me, dismiss this as foolishness? I rise in agitation, preparing for an argument. You said yourself you thought that we could do it. That morning of the reaping, you said... He steps in, and I feel myself lifted off the ground. The room spins, and I have to lock my arms around Gale's neck to brace myself. He's laughing, happy. Hey, I protest, but I'm laughing too. Gale sets me down, but doesn't release his hold on me.
Okay, let's run away, he says.
Really? You don't think I'm mad? You'll go with me? Some of the crushing weight begins to lift as it transfers to Gale's shoulders.
I do think you're mad, and I'll still go with you, he says.
He means it. Not only means it, but welcomes it.
We can do it. I know we can. Let's get out of here and never come back.
You're sure? I say. Because it's going to be hard, with the kids and all. I don't want to get 5 miles into the woods and have you...
I'm sure. I'm completely, entirely, 100% sure.
He tilts his forehead down to rest against mine and pulls me closer. His skin, his whole being, radiates heat from being so near the fire, and I close my eyes, soaking in his warmth. I breathe in the smell of snow-dampened leather and smoke and apples, the smell of all those wintry days we shared before the games. I don't try to move away. Why should I anyway? His voice drops to a whisper. I love you. That's why. I never see these things coming. They happen too fast. One second, you're proposing an escape plan, and the next, you're expected to deal with something like this? I come up with what must be the worst possible response. I know. It sounds terrible. Like I assume he couldn't help loving me, but that I don't feel anything in return. Gale starts to draw away, but I grab hold of him. I know, and you know what you are to me. It's not enough. He breaks my grip. Gale, I can't think about anyone that way now. All I can think about every day, every waking minute, since they drew Prim's name at the reaping, is how afraid I am. And there doesn't seem to be room for anything else. If we could get somewhere safe, maybe I could be different. I don't know. I can see him swallowing his disappointment. So, we'll go. We'll find out. He turns back to the fire, where the chestnuts are beginning to burn. He flips them out onto the hearth. My mother's going to take some convincing. I guess he's still going anyway. But the happiness has fled, leaving an all too familiar strain in its place. Mine too. I'll just have to make her see reason. Take her for a long walk. Make sure she understands we won't survive the alternative.
She'll understand. I watched a lot of the games with her and Prim. She won't say no to you,
says Gale. I hope not. The temperature in the house seems to have dropped 20 degrees in a matter of seconds. Haymitch will be the real challenge.
Haymitch? Gale abandons the chestnuts. You're not asking him to come with us.
I have to, Gale. I can't leave him and Peter because they'd... His scowl cuts me off. What?
I'm sorry, I didn't realize how large our party was, he snaps at me.
They tortured them to death trying to find out where I was, I say.
What about PETA's family? They'll never come. In fact, they probably couldn't wait to inform on us, which I'm sure he's smart enough to realize.
What if he decides to stay? He asks. I try to sound indifferent, but my voice cracks. Then he stays.
You'd leave him behind? Gale asks.
To save Prim and my mother, yes, I answer. I mean, no, I'll get him to come.
And me? Would you leave me?
Gale's expression is rock hard now.
Just if, for instance, I can't convince my mother to drag 3 young kids into the wilderness in winter.
Hazel won't refuse. She'll see sense, I say.
Suppose she doesn't, Katniss. What then? He demands.
Then you have to force her, Gale. Do you think I'm making this stuff up? My voice is rising in anger as well.
No, I don't know. Maybe the president's just manipulating you. I mean, he's throwing your wedding. You saw how the Capitol crowd reacted. I don't think he can afford to kill you or PETA. How's he going to get out of that one? Says Gale.
Well, with an uprising in District 8, I doubt he's spending much time choosing my wedding cake, I shout. The instant the words are out of my mouth, I want to reclaim them. Their effect on Gale is immediate. The flush on his cheeks, the brightness of his gray eyes.
There's an uprising in 8? He says in a hushed voice.
I try to backpedal, to defuse him, as I tried to defuse the districts. I don't know if it's really an uprising. There's unrest. People in the streets, I say.
Gale grabs my shoulders. What did you see?
Nothing, in person. I just heard something. As usual, it's too little, too late. I give up and tell him. I saw something on the mayor's television. I wasn't supposed to. There was a crowd and fires, and the peacekeepers were gunning people down, but they were fighting back. I bite my lip and struggle to continue describing the scene. Instead, I say aloud the words that have been eating me up inside.
And it's my fault, Gale. Because of what I did in the arena. If I had just killed myself with those berries, none of this would have happened. Peter could have come home and lived, and everyone else would have been safe, too.
Safe to do what? He says in a gentler tone. Starve? Work like slaves? Send their kids to the reaping? You haven't hurt people. You've given them an opportunity. They just have to be brave enough to take it. There's already been talk in the mines. People who want to fight. Don't you see? It's happening. It's finally happening. If there's an uprising in District 8, why not here? Why not everywhere? This could be it. The thing we've been...
Stop it! You don't know what you're saying. The peacekeepers outside of 12, they're not like Darius or even Cray. The lives of district people, they mean less than nothing to them, I say.
That's why we have to join the fight, he answers harshly.
No, we have to leave here before they kill us and a lot of other people too.
I'm yelling again, but I can't understand why he's doing this. Why doesn't he see what's so undeniable?
Gale pushes me roughly away from him. You leave, then. I'd never go in a million years.
You were happy enough to go before. I don't see how an uprising in District 8 does anything but make it more important that we leave. You're just mad about...
No, I can't throw PETA in his face.
What about your family?
What about the other families, Katniss? The ones who can't run away. Don't you see? It can't be about just saving us anymore. Not if the rebellion's begun.
Gale shakes his head, not hiding his disgust with me.
You could do so much.
He throws Cinna's gloves at my feet.
I changed my mind. I don't want anything they made in the capital.
And he's gone. I look down at the gloves. Anything they made in the capital? Was that directed at me? Does he think I am now just another product of the capital and therefore something untouchable? The unfairness of it all fills me with rage. But it's mixed up with fear over what kind of crazy thing he might do next. I sink down next to the fire, desperate for comfort, to work out my next move. I calm myself by thinking that rebellions don't happen in a day. Gale can't talk to the miners until tomorrow. If I can get to Hazel before then, she might straighten him out. But I can't go now. If he's there, he'll lock me out. Maybe tonight, after everyone else is asleep. Hazel often works late into the night finishing up laundry. I could go then, tap at the window, tell her the situation, so she'll keep Gale from doing anything foolish. My conversation with President Snow in the study comes back to me.
My advisors were concerned you would be difficult, but you're not planning on being difficult at all, are you?
No.
That's what I told them. I said any girl who goes to such lengths to preserve her life isn't going to be interested in throwing it away with both hands.
I think of how hard Hazel has worked to keep that family alive. Surely... she'll be on my side in this matter. Or won't she? It must be getting on toward noon now, and the days are so short. No point in being in the woods after dark if you don't have to. I stamp out the remains of my little fire, clear up the scraps of food, and tuck Cinna's gloves in my belt. I guess I'll hang on to them for a while, in case Gale has a change of heart. I think of the look on his face when he flung them to the ground. How repelled he was by them. By me. I trudge through the woods and reach my old house while there's still light. My conversation with Gale was an obvious setback, but I'm still determined to carry on with my plan to escape District 12. I decide to find PETA next. In a strange way, since he's seen some of what I've seen on the tour, he may be an easier sell than Gale was. I run into him as he's leaving the Victor's village.
Been hunting? He asks.
You can see he doesn't think it's a good idea. Not really. Going to town? I ask.
Yes. I'm supposed to eat dinner with my family, he says.
Well, I can at least walk with you. The road from the Victor's village to the square gets little use. It's a safe enough place to talk, but I can't seem to get the words out. Proposing it to Gale was such a disaster. I gnaw on my chapped lips. The square gets closer with every step. I may not have an opportunity again soon. I take a deep breath and let the words rush out. Peter, if I asked you to run away from the district with me, would you?
Peter takes my arm, bringing me to a stop. He doesn't need to check my face to see if I'm serious.
Depends on why you're asking.
President Snow wasn't convinced by me. There's an uprising in District 8. We have to get out,
I say.
By we, do you mean just you and me?
No.
Who else would be going? He asks.
My family, yours, if they want to come. Hamish, maybe, I say.
What about Gale? He says.
I don't know. He might have other plans,
I say.
Peter shakes his head and gives me a rueful smile.
I bet he does.
Sure, Katniss. I'll go.
I feel a slight twinge of hope. You will?
Yeah, but I don't think for a minute you will, he says.
I jerk my arm away. Then you don't know me. Be ready. It could be any time. I take off walking, and he follows a pace or two behind.
Katniss, Peter says.
I don't slow down. If he thinks it's a bad idea, I don't want to know because it's the only one I have.
Katniss, hold up.
I kick a dirty frozen chunk of snow off the path and let him catch up. The coal dust makes everything look especially ugly.
I really will go if you want me to. I just think we better talk it through with Hamish. Make sure we won't be making things worse for everyone.
He raises his head.
What's that?
I lift my chin. I've been so consumed with my own worries, I haven't noticed the strange noise coming from the square. A whistling, the sound of an impact, the intake of breath from a crowd.
Come on, Peter says, his face suddenly hard.
I don't know why. I can't place the sound, even guess at the situation. But it means something bad to him. When we reach the square, it's clear something's happening, but the crowd's too thick to see. Peter steps up on a crate against the wall of the sweet shop and offers me a hand while he scans the square. I'm halfway up when he suddenly blocks my way.
Get down. Get out of here.
He's whispering, but his voice is harsh with insistence.
What?
I say, trying to force my way back up.
Go home, Katniss. I'll be there in a minute, I swear, he says.
Whatever it is, it's terrible. I yank away from his hand and begin to push my way through the crowd. People see me, recognize my face, and then look panicked. Hands shove me back, voices hiss.
Get out of here, girl! Only make it worse! What do you want to do, get him killed?
But at this point, my heart is beating so fast and fierce, I hardly hear them. I only know that whatever waits in the middle of the square is meant for me. When I finally break through to the cleared space, I see I am right, and Peter was right, and those voices were right, too.
Gale's wrists are bound to a wooden post. The wild turkey he shot earlier hangs above him, the nail driven through its neck.
His jacket's been cast aside on the ground, his shirt torn away. He slumps unconscious on his knees, held up only by the ropes at his wrists. What used to be his back is a raw, bloody slab of meat. Standing behind him is a man I've never seen, but I recognize his uniform. It's the one designated for our head peacekeeper. This isn't old Cray, though. This is a tall, muscular man with sharp creases in his pants. The pieces of the picture do not quite come together until I see his arm raise the whip.
Chapter 8.
No!
I cry and spring forward.
It's too late to stop the arm from descending, and I instinctively know I won't have the power to block it. Instead, I throw myself directly between the whip and Gale. I've flung out my arms to protect as much of his broken body as possible, so there's nothing to deflect the lash. I take the full force of it across the left side of my face. The pain is blinding and instantaneous. Jagged flashes of light cross my vision, and I fall to my knees. One hand cups my cheek, while the other keeps me from tipping over. I can already feel the welt rising up, the swelling closing my eye. The stones beneath me are wet with Gale's blood, the air heavy with its scent. "Stop it! You'll kill him!" I shriek. I get a glimpse of my assailant's face. Hard, with deep lines, a cruel mouth. Gray hair shaved almost to non-existence. Eyes so black, they seem all pupils. A long, straight nose reddened by the freezing air. The powerful arm lifts again, his sights set on me. My hand flies to my shoulder, hungry for an arrow, but of course my weapons are stashed in the woods. I grit my teeth in anticipation of the next lash.
"Hold it!"
a voice barks. Haymitch appears and trips over a peacekeeper lying on the ground. It's Darius. A huge purple lump pushes through the red hair on his forehead. He's knocked out, but still breathing. What happened? Did he try to come to Gale's aid before I got here? Haymitch ignores him and pulls me to my feet roughly.
"Oh, excellent!"
His hand locks under my chin, lifting it. "She's got a photo shoot next week modeling wedding dresses. What am I supposed to tell her stylist?" I see a flicker of recognition in the eyes of the man with the whip. Bundled against the cold, my face free of makeup, my braid tucked carelessly under my coat, it wouldn't be easy to identify me as the victor of the last Hunger Games. Especially with half my face swelling up. But Haymitch has been showing up on television for years, and he'd be difficult to forget. The man rests the whip on his hip.
"She interrupted the punishment of a confessed criminal."
Everything about this man, his commanding voice, his odd accent, warns of an unknown and dangerous threat. Where has he come from? District 11? 3? From the Capitol itself?
"I don't care if she blew up the blasted justice building. Look at her cheek. Think that will be camera ready in a week?"
Haymitch snarls. The man's voice is still cold, but I can detect a slight edge of doubt.
"That's not my problem." "No. Well, it's about to be, my friend. The first call I make when I get home is to the Capitol," says Haymitch. "Find out who authorized you to mess up my victor's pretty little face." "He was poaching. What business is it of hers anyway?" says the man.
"He's her cousin. Peeta's got my other arm now, but gently. And she's my fiancé, so if you want to get to him, expect to go through both of us." Maybe we're it, the only three people in the district who could make a stand like this. Although it's sure to be temporary. There will be repercussions, but at the moment, all I care about is keeping Gale alive. The new head peacekeeper glances over at his backup squad. With relief, I see their familiar faces, old friends from the Hob. You can tell by their expressions that they're not enjoying the show. One, a woman named Pernia, who eats regularly at Greasy Say's, steps forward stiffly.
"I believe, for a first offense, the required number of lashes has been dispensed, sir, unless your sentence is death, which we would carry out by firing squad."
"Is that the standard protocol here?" asks the head peacekeeper.
"Yes, sir," Pernia says.
and several others nod in agreement. I'm sure none of them actually know, because in the Hob, the standard protocol for someone showing up with a wild turkey is for everybody to bid on the drumsticks.
Very well. Get your cousin out of here then, girl. And if he comes too, remind him that the next time he poaches off the capital's land, I'll assemble the firing squad personally.
The head peacekeeper wipes his hand along the length of the whip, splattering us with blood. Then he coils it into quick, neat loops and walks off. Most of the other peacekeepers fall in an awkward formation behind him. A small group stays behind and hoists Darius's body up by the arms and legs. I catch Pernia's eye and mouth the words, "Thanks," before she goes. She doesn't respond, but I'm sure she understood.
"Gale?"
I turn my hands, fumbling at the knots binding his wrists. Someone passes forward a knife, and Peter cuts the ropes. Gale collapses to the ground.
"Better get him to your mother," says Haymitch.
There's no stretcher, but the old woman at the clothing stall sells us the board that serves as her countertop.
"Just don't tell where you got it," she says, packing up the rest of her goods quickly.
Most of the square is emptied, fear getting the better of compassion. But after what just happened, I can't blame anyone. By the time we've laid Gale face down on the board, there's only a handful of people left to carry him. Haymitch, Peeta, and a couple of miners who work on the same crew as Gale lift him up. Levy, a girl who lives a few houses down from mine in the seam, takes my arm. My mother kept her little brother alive last year when he caught the measles.
"Need help getting back?"
Her gray eyes are scared but determined.
"No, but can you get Hazel? Send her over?"
I ask.
"Yeah,"
says Levy, turning on her heel.
"Levy,"
I say,
"don't let her bring the kids." "No, I'll stay with them myself,"
she says.
"Thanks."
I grab Gale's jacket and hurry after the others.
"Get some snow on that,"
Haymitch orders over his shoulder. I scoop up a handful of snow and press it against my cheek, numbing a bit of the pain. My left eye's tearing heavily now, and in the dimming light it's all I can do to follow the boots in front of me. As we walk, I hear Bristol and Tom, Gale's crewmates, piece together the story of what happened. Gale must have gone to Cray's house, as he's done 100 times, knowing Cray always pays well for a wild turkey. Instead, he found the new head peacekeeper, a man they heard someone call Romulus Thread. No one knows what happened to Cray. He was buying white liquor in the Hob just this morning, apparently still in command of the district, but now he's nowhere to be found. Thread put Gale under immediate arrest, and of course, since he was standing there holding a dead turkey, there was little Gale could say in his own defense. Word of his predicament spread quickly. He was brought to the square, forced to plead guilty to his crime, and sentenced to a whipping to be carried out immediately. By the time I showed up, he'd been lashed at least 40 times. He passed out around 30.
"Lucky he only had the turkey on him," says Bristol. "If he'd had his usual haul, would have been much worse."
"He told Thread he found it wandering around the seam, said it got over the fence, and he'd stabbed it with a stick. Still a crime, but if they'd known he'd been in the woods with weapons, they'd have killed him for sure," says Tom.
"What about Darius?" Peeta asks.
"After about 20 lashes, he stepped in, saying that was enough. Only he didn't do it smart and official, like Pernia did. He grabbed Thread's arm, and Thread hit him in the head with the butt of the whip. Nothing good waiting for him," says Bristol.
"Doesn't sound like much good for any of us," says Haymitch.
Snow begins, thick and wet, making visibility even more difficult. I stumble up the walk to my house behind the others, using my ears more than my eyes to guide me. A golden light colors the snow as the door opens. My mother, who was no doubt waiting for me after a long day of unexplained absence,
takes in the scene.
"New head,"
Haymitch says, and she gives him a curt nod, as if no other explanation is needed. I'm filled with awe, as I always am, as I watch her transform from a woman who calls me to kill a spider to a woman immune to fear. When a sick or dying person is brought to her, this is the only time I think my mother knows who she is. In moments, the long kitchen table has been cleared, a sterile white cloth spread across it, and Gale hoisted onto it. My mother pours water from a kettle into a basin while ordering Prim to pull a series of her remedies from the medicine cabinet. Dried herbs and tinctures and store-bought bottles. I watch her hands, the long, tapered fingers, crumbling this, adding drops of that into the basin, soaking a cloth in the hot liquid as she gives Prim instructions to prepare a second brew. My mother glances my way. "Did it cut your eye?"
"No, it's just swelled shut," I say.
"Get more snow on it," she instructs, but I am clearly not a priority.
"Can you save him?"
I ask my mother. She says nothing as she wrings out the cloth and holds it in the air to cool somewhat.
"Don't worry," says Haymitch. "Used to be a lot of whipping before Cray. She's the one we took them to."
I can't remember a time before Cray, a time when there was a head peacekeeper who used the whip freely. But my mother must have been around my age and still working at the apothecary shop with her parents. Even back then, she must have had healer's hands. Ever so gently, she begins to clean the mutilated flesh on Gale's back. I feel sick to my stomach, useless, the remaining snow dripping from my glove into a puddle on the floor. Peter puts me in a chair and holds a cloth filled with fresh snow to my cheek. Haymitch tells Bristol and Tom to get home, and I see him press coins into their hands before they leave.
"Don't know what will happen with your crew," he says.
They nod and accept the money.
Hazel arrives, breathless and flushed, fresh snow in her hair. Wordlessly, she sits on a stool next to the table, takes Gale's hand, and holds it against her lips. My mother doesn't acknowledge even her. She's gone into that special zone that includes only herself and the patient and occasionally Prim. The rest of us can wait. Even in her expert hands, it takes a long time to clean the wounds, arrange what shredded skin can be saved, apply a salve and a light bandage. As the blood clears, I can see where every stroke of the lash landed and feel it resonate in the single cut on my face. I multiply my own pain once, twice, 40 times, and can only hope that Gale remains unconscious. Of course, that's too much to ask for. As the final bandages are being placed, a moan escapes his lips. Hazel strokes his hair and whispers something while my mother and Prim go through their meager store of painkillers, the kind usually accessible only to doctors. They're hard to come by, expensive, and always in demand. My mother has to save the strongest for the worst pain. But what is the worst pain? To me, it's always the pain that is present. If I were in charge, those painkillers would be gone in a day, because I have so little ability to watch suffering. My mother tries to save them for those who are actually in the process of dying, to ease them out of the world. Since Gale is regaining consciousness, they decide on an herbal concoction he can take by mouth. "That won't be enough,"
I say. They stare at me.
"That won't be enough. I know how it feels. That will barely knock out a headache."
"We'll combine it with sleep syrup, Katniss, and he'll manage it. The herbs are more for the inflammation," my mother begins calmly.
"Just give him the medicine,"
I scream at her.
"Give it to him. Who are you, anyway, to decide how much pain he can stand?"
Gale begins stirring at my voice, trying to reach me. The movement causes fresh blood to stain his bandages and an agonized sound to come from his mouth. "Take her out," says my mother. Haymitch and Peter literally carry me from the room while I shout obscenities at her.
They pin me down on a bed in one of the extra bedrooms until I stop fighting. While I lie there, sobbing, tears trying to squeeze out of the slit of my eye, I hear Peeta whisper to Haymitch about President Snow, about the uprising in District 8. "She wants us all to run," he says. But if Haymitch has an opinion on this, he doesn't offer it. After a while, my mother comes in and treats my face. Then she holds my hand, stroking my arm, while Haymitch fills her in on what happened with Gail. "So it's starting again," she says, "like before."
"By the looks of it," he answers. "Who'd have thought we'd ever be sorry to see old Cray go?"
Cray would have been disliked anyway, because of the uniform he wore, but it was his habit of luring starving young women into his bed for money that made him an object of loathing in the district. In really bad times, the hungriest would gather at his door at nightfall, vying for the chance to earn a few coins to feed their families by selling their bodies. Had I been older when my father died, I might have been among them. Instead, I learned to hunt. I don't know exactly what my mother means by things starting again, but I'm too angry and hurting to ask. It's registered, though, the idea of worse times returning, because when the doorbell rings, I shoot straight out of bed. Who could it be at this hour of the night? There's only one answer. Peacekeepers. "They can't have him," I say.
"Might be you thereafter," Haymitch reminds me.
"Or you," I say.
"Not my house," Haymitch points out, "but I'll get the door."
"No, I'll get it," says my mother quietly. We all go, though, following her down the hallway to the insistent ring of the bell. When she opens it, there's not a squad of peacekeepers, but a single snow-caked figure. Madge. She holds out a small, damp cardboard box to me. "Use this on your friend," she says. I take off the lid of the box, revealing half a dozen vials of clear liquid. "They're my mother's. She said I could take them. Use them, please." She runs back into the storm before we can stop her.
"Crazy girl,"
Haymitch mutters as we follow my mother into the kitchen. Whatever my mother had given Gail, I was right. It isn't enough. His teeth are gritted and his flesh shines with sweat. My mother fills a syringe with the clear liquid from one of the vials and shoots it into his arm. Almost immediately, his face begins to relax.
"What is that stuff?" asks Peeta.
"It's from the capital. It's called Morphling," my mother answers.
"I didn't even know Madge knew Gail," says Peeta.
"We used to sell her strawberries," I say almost angrily. What am I angry about, though? Not that she has brought the medicine, surely.
"She must have quite a taste for them," says Haymitch.
That's what nettles me. It's the implication that there's something going on between Gail and Madge, and I don't like it. "She's my friend," is all I say. Now that Gail has drifted away on the painkiller, everyone seems to deflate. Prim makes us each eat some stew and bread. A room is offered to Hazel, but she has to go home to the kids. Haymitch and Peeta are both willing to stay, but my mother sends them home to bed as well. She knows it's pointless to try this with me, and leaves me to tend to Gail while she and Prim rest. Alone in the kitchen with Gail, I sit on Hazel's stool, holding his hand. After a while, my fingers find his face. I touch parts of him I've never had cause to touch before. His heavy, dark eyebrows, the curve of his cheek, the line of his nose, the hollow at the base of his neck. I trace the outline of stubble on his jaw, and finally work my way to his lips. Soft and full, slightly chapped. His breath warms my chilled skin. Does everyone look younger asleep? Because right now he could be the boy I ran into in the woods years ago, the one who accused me of stealing from his traps. What a pair we were, fatherless, frightened, but fiercely committed, too, to keeping our families alive. Desperate, yet no longer alone after that day, because we'd found each other. I think of 100 moments in the woods, lazy afternoons, fishing, the day I taught him to swim, that time I twisted my knee and he carried me home. Mutually counting on each other, watching each other's backs, forcing each other to be brave. For the first time, I reverse our positions in my head. I imagine watching Gale volunteering to save Rory in the reaping, having him torn from my life, becoming some strange girl's lover to stay alive, and then coming home with her, living next to her, promising to marry her. The hatred I feel for him, for the phantom girl, for everything is so real and immediate that it chokes me. Gale is mine. I am his. Anything else is unthinkable. Why did it take him being whipped within an inch of his life to see it? Because I'm selfish. I'm a coward. I'm the kind of girl who, when she might actually be of use, would run to stay alive and leave those who couldn't follow to suffer and die. This is the girl Gale met in the woods today. No wonder I won the games. No decent person ever does. You saved Peter, I think, weakly. But now I question even that. I knew good and well that my life back in District 12 would have been unlivable if I let that boy die. I rest my head forward on the edge of the table, overcome with loathing for myself, wishing I had died in the arena, wishing Seneca Crane had blown me to bits the way President Snow said he should have when I held out the berries. The berries. I realize the answer to who I am lies in that handful of poisonous fruit. If I held them out to save Peter because I knew I would be shunned if I came back without him, then I am despicable. If I held them out because I loved him, I'm still self-centered, although forgivable. But if I held them out to defy the capital, I am someone of worth. The trouble is, I don't know exactly what was going on inside me at that moment. Could it be the people in the districts are right? That it was an act of rebellion, even if it was an unconscious one? Because deep down, I must know it isn't enough to keep myself or my family or my friends alive by running away. Even if I could, it wouldn't fix anything. It wouldn't stop people from being hurt the way Gale was today. Life in District 12 isn't really so different from life in the arena. At some point, you have to stop running and turn around and face whoever wants you dead. The hard thing is finding the courage to do it. Well, it's not hard for Gale. He was born a rebel. I'm the one making an escape plan. I'm so sorry, I whisper. I lean forward and kiss him. His eyelashes flutter, and he looks at me through a haze of opiates.
Hey, Catnip.
Hey, Gale, I say.
Thought you'd be gone by now, he says.
My choices are simple. I can die like Quarry in the woods, or I can die here beside Gale. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay right here and cause all kinds of trouble.
Me too,
Gale says. He just manages a smile before the drugs pull him back under.
Chapter 9. Someone gives my shoulder a shake and I sit up. I've fallen asleep with my face on the table. The white cloth has left creases on my good cheek. The other, the one that took the lash from Thread, throbs painfully. Gale's dead to the world, but his fingers are locked around mine. I smell fresh bread and turn my stiff neck to find Peter looking down at me with such a sad expression. I get the sense that he's been watching us a while.
Go on up to bed, Katniss. I'll look after him now, he says.
Peter, about what I said yesterday, about running, I begin.
I know, he says. There's nothing to explain. I see the loaves of bread on the counter in the pale, snowy morning light, the blue shadows under his eyes. I wonder if he slept at all. Couldn't have been long. I think of his agreeing to go with me yesterday, his stepping up beside me to protect Gale, his willingness to throw his lot in with mine entirely when I give him so little in return. No matter what I do, I'm hurting someone. Peter, just go to bed, okay? He says. I feel my way up the stairs, crawl under the covers, and fall asleep at once. At some point, Clove, the girl from District 2, enters my dreams. She chases me, pins me to the ground, and pulls out a knife to cut my face. It digs deeply into my cheek, opening a wide gash. Then Clove begins to transform, her face elongating into a snout, dark fur sprouting from her skin, her fingernails growing into long claws. But her eyes remain unchanged. She becomes the mutation form of herself, the wolf-like creation of the capital that terrorized us the last night in the arena. Tossing back her head, she lets out a long, eerie howl that is picked up by other mutts nearby. Clove begins to lap the blood flowing from my wound, each lick sending a new wave of pain through my face. I give a strangled cry and wake with a start, sweating and shivering at once. Cradling my damaged cheek in my hand, I remind myself that it was not Clove, but Thread who gave me this wound. I wish that Peter were here to hold me, until I remember I'm not supposed to wish that anymore. I have chosen Gale and the Rebellion, and a future with Peter is the Capital's design, not mine. The swelling around my eye has gone down, and I can open it a bit. I push aside the curtains and see the snowstorm has strengthened to a full-out blizzard. There's nothing but whiteness and the howling wind that sounds remarkably like the mutations. I welcome the blizzard with its ferocious winds and deep drifting snow. This may be enough to keep the real wolves, also known as the peacekeepers, from my door. A few days to think, to work out a plan. With Gale and Peter and Haymitch all at hand, this blizzard is a gift. Before I go down to face this new life, though, I take some time making myself acknowledge what it will mean. Less than a day ago, I was prepared to head into the wilderness with my loved ones in midwinter, with the very real possibility of the Capital pursuing us. A precarious venture at best, but now I am committing to something even more risky. Fighting the Capital assures their swift retaliation. I must accept that at any moment I can be arrested. There will be a knock on the door, like the one last night, a band of peacekeepers to haul me away. There might be torture, mutilation, a bullet through my skull in the town square, if I am fortunate enough to go that quickly. The Capital has no end of creative ways to kill people. I imagine these things, and I'm terrified, but let's face it, they've been lurking in the back of my brain anyway. I've been a tribute in the games, been threatened by the president, taken a lash across my face. I'm already a target. Now comes the harder part. I have to face the fact that my family and friends might share this fate. Prim. I need only to think of Prim and all my resolve disintegrates. It's my job to protect her. I pull the blanket up over my head, and my breathing is so rapid I use up all the oxygen and begin to choke for air. I can't let the Capital hurt Prim. And then it hits me. They already have. They have killed her father in those wretched mines. They have sat by as she almost starved to death. They have chosen her as a tribute, then made her watch her sister fight to the death in the games. She has been hurt far worse than I had at the age of 12, and even that pales in comparison with Rue's life. I shove off the blanket and suck in the cold air that seeps through the window panes. Prim, Rue, aren't they the very reason I have to try to fight?
because what has been done to them is so wrong, so beyond justification, so evil that there is no choice. Because no one has the right to treat them as they have been treated?
Yes, this is the thing to remember when fear threatens to swallow me up. What I am about to do, whatever any of us are forced to endure, it is for them. It's too late to help Rue, but maybe not too late for those 5 little faces that looked up at me from the square in District 11. Not too late for Rory and Vic and Posey. Not too late for Prim. Gail is right. If people have the courage, this could be an opportunity. He's also right that since I have set it in motion, I could do so much. Although I have no idea what exactly that should be. But deciding not to run away is a crucial first step. I take a shower, and this morning my brain is not assembling lists of supplies for the wild, but trying to figure out how they organize that uprising in District 8. So many, so clearly acting in defiance of the capital. Was it even planned, or something that simply erupted out of years of hatred and resentment? How could we do that here? Would the people of District 12 join in or lock their doors? Yesterday the square emptied so quickly after Gale's whipping. But isn't that because we all feel so impotent and have no idea what to do? We need someone to direct us and reassure us this is possible. And I don't think I'm that person. I may have been a catalyst for rebellion, but a leader should be someone with conviction, and I'm barely a convert myself. Someone with unflinching courage, and I'm still working hard at even finding mine. Someone with clear and persuasive words, and I'm so easily tongue-tied. Words. I think of words, and I think of Peter, how people embrace everything he says. He could move a crowd to action, I bet, if he chose to. Would find the things to say. But I'm sure the idea has never crossed his mind. Downstairs I find my mother and Prim tending to a subdued Gale. The medicine must be wearing off by the look on his face. I brace myself for another fight, but try to keep my voice calm. Can't you give him another shot? I will, if it's needed.
We thought we'd try the snow coat first, says my mother. She has removed his bandages. You can practically see the heat radiating off his back. She lays a clean cloth across his angry flesh and nods to Prim. Prim comes over, stirring what appears to be a large bowl of snow. But it's tinted a light green and gives off a sweet, clean scent. Snow coat. She carefully begins to ladle the stuff onto the cloth. I can almost hear the sizzle of Gale's tormented skin meeting the snow mixture. His eyes flutter open, perplexed, and then he lets out a sound of relief. It's lucky we have snow, says my mother. I think of what it must be like to recover from a whipping in midsummer with the searing heat and the tepid water from the tap. What did you do in warm months? I ask. A crease appears between my mother's eyebrows as she frowns. Tried to keep the flies away. My stomach turns at the thought. She fills a handkerchief with the snow coat mixture, and I hold it to the wheel on my cheek. Instantly the pain withdraws. It's the coldness of the snow, yes, but whatever mix of herbal juices my mother has added numbs as well. Oh, that's wonderful. Why didn't you put this on him last night?
I needed the wound to set first, she says.
I don't know what that means exactly, but as long as it works, who am I to question her? She knows what she's doing, my mother. I feel a pang of remorse about yesterday. The awful things I yelled at her as Peter and Hamish dragged me from the kitchen. I'm sorry about screaming at you yesterday.
I've heard worse, she says. You've seen how people are when someone they love is in pain.
Someone they love. The words numb my tongue as if it's been packed in snow coat. Of course, I love Gale. But what kind of love does she mean?
What do I mean when I say I love Gale?
I don't know. I did kiss him last night, in a moment when my emotions were running so high, but I'm sure he doesn't remember it, does he?
I hope not. If he does, everything will just get more complicated, and I really can't think about kissing when I've got a rebellion to incite. I give my head a little shake to clear it.
Where's Peter? I say.
He went home when we heard you stirring. Didn't want to leave his house unattended during the storm, says my mother.
Did he get back all right?
I ask. In a blizzard, you can get lost in a matter of yards and wander off course into oblivion. Why don't you give him a call and check? She says.
I go into the study, a room I've pretty much avoided since my meeting with President Snow, and dial Peter's number. After a few rings, he answers.
Hey, I just wanted to make sure you got home, I say.
Katniss, I live 3 houses away from you, he says.
I know, but with the weather and all, I say.
Well, I'm fine. Thank you for checking. There's a long pause. How's Gale?
All right. My mother and Prim are giving him snow coat now, I say.
And your face? He asks.
I've got some, too, I say. Have you seen Haymitch today?
I checked in on him, dead drunk, but I built up his fire and left him some bread, he says.
I wanted to talk to both of you.
I don't dare add more here on my phone, which is surely tapped. Probably have to wait until after the weather calms down, he says. Nothing much will happen before that, anyway.
No, nothing much, I agree. It takes 2 days for the storm to blow itself out, leaving us with drifts higher than my head. Another day before the path is cleared from the victor's village to the square. During this time I help tend to Gale, apply snow coat to my cheek, try to remember everything I can about the uprising in District 8, in case it will help us. The swelling in my face goes down, leaving me with an itchy, healing wound and a very black eye. But still, the first chance I get, I call Peter to see if he wants to go into town with me. We rouse Haymitch and drag him along with us. He complains, but not as much as usual. We all know we need to discuss what happened, and it can't be anywhere as dangerous as our homes in the victor's village. In fact, we wait until the village is well behind us to even speak. I spend the time studying the 10-foot walls of snow piled up on either side of the narrow path that has been cleared, wondering if they will collapse in on us. Finally, Haymitch breaks the silence.
"So, we're all heading off into the great unknown, are we?" he asks me.
"No," I say, "not anymore."
"Worked through the flaws in that plan, did you, sweetheart?" he asks. "Any new ideas?"
"I want to start an uprising," I say.
Haymitch just laughs. It's not even a mean laugh, which is more troubling. It shows he can't even take me seriously.
"Well, I want a drink. You let me know how that works out for you, though," he says.
"Then what's your plan?" I spit back at him.
"My plan is to make sure everything is just perfect for your wedding," says Haymitch. "I called and rescheduled the photo shoot without giving too many details."
"You don't even have a phone," I say.
"Effie had that fixed," he says. "Do you know she asked me if I'd like to give you away? I told her the sooner the better."
"Haymitch," I can hear the pleading creeping into my voice.
"Katniss," he mimics my tone.
"It won't work."
We shut up as a team of men with shovels passes us, headed out to the victor's village. Maybe they can do something about those 10-foot walls. And by the time they're out of earshot, the square is too close. We step into it and all come to a stop simultaneously. Nothing much will happen during the blizzard.
That's what Peter and I had agreed, but we couldn't have been more wrong.
The square has been transformed. A huge banner with the seal of Panem hangs off the roof of the Justice Building. Peacekeepers in pristine white uniforms march on the cleanly swept cobblestones. Along the rooftops,
More of them occupy nests of machine guns. Most unnerving is a line of new constructions, an official whipping post, several stockades, and a gallows, set up in the center of the square.
"Thread's a quick worker," says Haymitch.
Some streets away from the square, I see a blaze flare up. None of us has to say it. That can only be the hob going up in smoke. I think of Greasy Say, Ripper, all my friends who make their living there. "Haymitch, you don't think everyone's still in?" I can't finish the sentence.
"Nah, they're smarter than that. You'd be too if you'd been around longer," he says. "Well, I better go see how much rubbing alcohol the apothecary can spare."
He trudges off across the square and I look at Peeta. What's he want that for? Then I realize the answer.
We can't let him drink it. He'll kill himself,
or at the very least go blind. I've got some white liquor put away at home.
Me too. Maybe that will hold him until Ripper finds a way to be back in business, says Peeta. I need to check on my family.
I have to go see Hazel. I'm worried now. I thought she'd be on our doorstep the moment the snow was cleared, but there's been no sign of her.
I'll go too. Drop by the bakery on my way home, he says.
Thanks. I'm suddenly very scared at what I might find. The streets are almost deserted, which would not be so unusual at this time of day if people were at the mines, kids at school, but they're not. I see faces peeking at us out of doorways, through cracks in shutters. An uprising, I think. What an idiot I am. There's an inherent flaw in the plan that both Gale and I were too blind to see. An uprising requires breaking the law, thwarting authority. We've done that our whole lives, or our families have. Poaching, trading on the black market, mocking the capital in the woods. But for most people in District 12, a trip to buy something at the hob would be too risky. And I expect them to assemble in the square with bricks and torches? Even the sight of Peeta and me is enough to make people pull their children away from the windows and draw the curtains tightly. We find Hazel in her house, nursing a very sick posy. I recognize the measles spots. I couldn't leave her, she says. I knew Gale'd be in the best possible hands.
Of course, I say. He's much better. My mother says he'll be back in the mines in a couple of weeks.
May not be open until then, anyway, says Hazel.
Word is they're closed until further notice.
She gives a nervous glance at her empty wash tub.
You close down too? I ask.
Not officially, says Hazel. But everyone's afraid to use me now.
Maybe it's the snow, says Peeta.
No, Rory made a quick round this morning. Nothing to wash, apparently, she says.
Rory wraps his arms around Hazel. We'll be all right.
I take a handful of money from my pocket and lay it on the table. My mother will send something for Posy.
When we're outside, I turn to Peeta.
You go on back. I want to walk by the hob.
I'll go with you, he says.
No, I've dragged you into enough trouble, I tell him.
And avoiding a stroll by the hob, that's going to fix things for me?
He smiles and takes my hand. Together we wind through the streets of the seam until we reach the burning building. They haven't even bothered to leave peacekeepers around it. They know no one would try to save it. The heat from the flames melts the surrounding snow, and a black trickle runs across my shoes. It's all that coal dust from the old days, I say. It was in every crack and crevice, ground into the floorboards. It's amazing the place didn't go up before. I want to check on Greasy Say.
Not today, Katniss. I don't think we'd be helping anyone by dropping in on them, he says.
We go back to the square. I buy some cakes from Peeta's father while they exchange small talk about the weather. No one mentions the ugly tools of torture, just yards from the front door. The last thing I notice as we leave the square is that I do not recognize even one of the peacekeepers' faces.
As the days pass, things go from bad to worse. The mines stay shut for 2 weeks, and by that time, half of District 12 is starving. The number of kids signing up for tesseries soars, but they often don't receive their grain. Food shortages begin, and even those with money come away from stores empty-handed. When the mines reopen, wages are cut, hours extended, miners sent into blatantly dangerous work sites. The eagerly awaited food promised for parcel day arrives spoiled and defiled by rodents. The installations in the square see plenty of action as people are dragged in and punished for offenses so long overlooked we've forgotten they are illegal. Gail goes home with no more talk of rebellion between us. But I can't help thinking that everything he sees will only strengthen his resolve to fight back. The hardships in the mines, the tortured bodies in the square, the hunger on the faces of his family. Rory has signed up for tesserae, something Gail can't even speak about, but it's still not enough with the inconsistent availability and the ever-increasing price of food. The only bright spot is, I get Hamish to hire Hazel as a housekeeper, resulting in some extra money for her and greatly increasing Hamish's standard of living. It's weird going into his house, finding it fresh and clean, food warming on the stove. He hardly notices because he's fighting a whole different battle. Peter and I tried to ration what white liquor we had, but it's almost run out, and the last time I saw Ripper, she was in the stocks. I feel like a pariah when I walk through the streets. Everyone avoids me in public now, but there's no shortage of company at home. A steady supply of ill and injured is deposited in our kitchen before my mother, who has long since stopped charging for her services. Her stocks of remedies are running so low, though, that soon all she'll have to treat the patients with is snow. The woods, of course, are forbidden. Absolutely. No question. Even Gail doesn't challenge this now. But one morning, I do. And it isn't the house full of the sick and dying, the bleeding backs, the gaunt-faced children, the marching boots, or the omnipresent misery that drives me under the fence. It's the arrival of a crate of wedding dresses one night, with a note from Effie saying that President Snow approved these himself. The wedding! Is he really planning to go through with it? What in his twisted brain will that achieve? Is it for the benefit of those in the capital? A wedding was promised, a wedding will be given, and then he'll kill us, as a lesson to the districts? I don't know. I can't make sense of it. I toss and turn in bed until I can't stand it anymore. I have to get out of here, at least for a few hours. My hands dig around in my closet until I find the insulated winter gear Cinna made for me for recreational use on the Victory Tour. Waterproof boots, a snowsuit that covers me from head to toe, thermal gloves. I love my old hunting stuff, but the trek I have in mind today is more suited to this high-tech clothing. I tiptoe downstairs, load my game bag with food, and sneak out of the house. Slinking along the side streets and back alleys, I make my way to the weak spot in the fence closest to Ruba the Butcher's. Since many workers cross this way to get to the mines, the snow's pockmarked with footprints. Mine will not be noticed. With all his security upgrades, Thread has paid little attention to the fence, perhaps feeling harsh weather and wild animals are enough to keep everyone safely inside. Even so, once I'm under the chain link, I cover my tracks until the trees conceal them for me. Dawn is just breaking as I retrieve a set of bow and arrows and begin to force a path through the drifted snow in the woods. I'm determined, for some reason, to get to the lake. Maybe to say goodbye to the place, to my father, and the happy times we spent there, because I know I'll probably never return. Maybe just so I can draw a complete breath again. Part of me doesn't really care if they catch me, if I can see it one more time. The trip takes twice as long as usual. Cinna's clothes hold in the heat all right,
and I arrive soaked with sweat under the snowsuit, while my face is numb with cold. The glare of the winter sun off the snow has played games with my vision, and I'm so exhausted and wrapped up in my own hopeless thoughts that I don't notice the signs. The thin stream of smoke from the chimney, the indentations of recent footprints, the smell of steam.